Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Reports President Trump may try to cut funding to the National Endowment for the Arts has groups, including some here in Delaware, a bit concerned.
It's important to be mindful about this and begin galvanizing the troops and informing people where we are.
We chat with Delaware Arts Alliance Executive Director Guillermina Gonzalez about what the impact of such a funding cut could be in the first state. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn about a pair of language-themed charter schools using their physical proximity to collaborate and take you to a local chicken farm to learn about its daily operations. Plus, we bring you the story of a 52-year-old Delawarean who's gone from homeless to studying at Penn. And hear another piece from our Generation Voice Youth Media Project at Mount Pleasant High School. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Barley Mill Plaza, the former DuPont Company office site just west of Wilmington, is now home to a pair of language-themed charter schools. Odyssey Charter landed there 3 years ago after unsuccessful attempts to take its growing school to a variety of other sites. Academia Antonia Alonso arrived last fall after saying so long to the Community Education Building, its previous home in downtown Wilmington. Their presence together creates a unique situation in Delaware. Two schools that emphasize multiculturalism and learning a second language, albeit with different approaches, sharing a campus and finding new ways to interact with each other. Contributor Larry Nagengast visited the two schools recently to learn more about how they've survived and thrived and how they're working together. His piece is available right now online at DelawarePublic.org, and this week he joined me to talk about what he found.
Let's start by looking at the two schools. Odyssey's been around since 2006, but is it fair to say it's become increasingly popular in recent years, and has its expansion come in conjunction with that growth and interest in?
What you're asking is absolutely true. Odyssey started out in 2006 and grew steadily as a K through 5 program until it reached an enrollment 400, 500 students in that area. And it leveled off at that point, and the parents of Odyssey students realized, we like this program, which has emphasis on Greek language, culture, and also teaches math in Greek as well. And there was an interest in continuing this beyond fifth grade. They didn't want their kids to lose this enthusiasm for Greek that they had had. They pushed for the school's board of directors to expand the age levels, and Odyssey then won approval from the State Department of Education to expand into a middle school, and then this year it has begun a high school program with the ninth grade. So yes, it has steadily grown. It's grown because it has become more popular. Enrollment is now up to 1,440 students. When they get to becoming a full K through 12 program, it'll be pushing close to 2,000 students.
But it did struggle to find this permanent home it now has at Barley Mill Plaza 3 years ago, correct?
Yes, it's been quite an odyssey for Odyssey in terms of moving around. They started in Wilmington. They were actually in a couple of locations, one of which was in a shopping center quite near Barley Mill, where they are now, in the shopping center where on Lancaster Pike, where there used to be a Pathmark supermarket. They used to be there. They had a facility at St. Thomas, the old St. Thomas Elementary School in Wilmington. So, yeah, they've moved around a bit. They tried to buy the Wanamaker building, which now Insight has on Augustine Cutoff. They weren't able to strike a deal there. Then they bought this historic Mundy Farm property up on Lancaster Pike near Hokesson, which was the site of the first Catholic mission church in Delaware. They ran into neighborhood opposition when they developed plans to put the school on that site. And then they landed at Barley Mill, and that was an interesting situation. The Barley Mill Plaza, which is formerly a DuPont office site, was purchased by Stoltz Realty people. There was a massive redevelopment plan that they had for houses, apartments, offices, stores, even a hotel. That got into a massive fight with county council, with residents, wound up in court. The rezoning that was approved was voided. And then after that, Stoltz decided to sell the property. They first sold about one-third of the 92 acres to Odyssey, and then later on, the remainder of the site was sold to Petinero, which is on the verge of coming up with a redevelopment plan for that portion of it.
How much did getting that spot at Barley Mill allow them to really move forward with the expansion plans? How necessary was it for them to have a sense of a permanent home before they could really start this full expansion of K-12?
I think it was, you know, absolutely essential. They wanted a site where they could have a full K-12 program in one location, rather than being, say, partially in the shopping center, partially in the old Catholic school, having half of it in one place, half in the other, and certainly there was not enough room even with those two to add the high school program.
How about Antonio Alonso? It's only been operating since 2014, 2015, but it's already made this major move that you discussed in your piece from the city to the suburbs. What has its first couple of years been like, and what prompted their move out of the city?
We wrote about this and talked about it close to a year ago, but you know, they were Antonio Alonso was one of the first two tenants of the community education building, which is the high-rise former MBNA, Bank of America, office building that the Longwood Foundation acquired and for use by charter schools. And the building was, it's rather palatial, plush mahogany walls, a huge cafeteria, a beautiful atrium, all this great stuff. But the logistics became a little bit overwhelming for Antonio Alonso, which started out as a kindergarten first grade program. The kids were either on the fourth floor or the sixth floor or whatever it was. I mean, they had to walk down a couple of flights of stairs to get to the cafeteria, but even worse, the way the arrangements was set up, they had to walk all the way down to the main level and then a block and a half to a parking lot for their recess. What's going on here is that, you know, they're finding out they're losing a lot of instructional time for, you know, with little feet walking, huge distances for them to have to traverse. And there were other issues as well. Teachers were having trouble accessing the building on weekends and nights. I mean, this stuff was covered in the lease, but it became an unanticipated problem for them. They realized that they would be better off in a different setting after 2 years. They contacted Odyssey, which had really purchased more land, more buildings than they needed, and they moved into one of the buildings that's part of the Odyssey complex last fall.
And that brings me to the next point, which is this setup at Barley Mill is not an equal partner situation. Odyssey is, in fact, kind of the landlord for Antonio Alonso, correct?
That's right. Odyssey's the landlord. Antonio Alonso is the tenant. But as of now, it's been a very good, very positive relationship, and the two schools are working together and collaborating in a number of ways.
We'll get that collaboration in a minute, but I did want to go back to Antonio Alonso and just, you know, how they're faring after these first 2 years. Do they feel pretty good about where they are in terms of what their plan for developing as a school is?
Yes, they are pleased. I mean, the rocky start that the school had led a number of students to withdraw early in that first semester of the first year, and it took a little bit of time for them to come back. But they're now a K-3 program. They're over 400 students enrolled, and they're planning on adding another 100 each year as they build out to being a K-5 program. They had management issues as well at the start. They went through three headmasters, heads of school within the first year, and then the current headmaster came on at the end of the first year. So he was at the community education building for the second year that they were there, and this is now his second full year with the program. And, you know, he's happy, he's pleased with the project progress that they're making right now.
Your piece does look at some of the collaboration between the two that you mentioned, and much of it seems to be kind of, you know, baby steps here at the outset. Can you give us some examples of what they're doing right now in terms of working with each other?
Academically, again, it's... You know, there's not a huge amount of room for collaboration. Antonio Alonso is a dual language immersion program with Spanish and English. Odyssey obviously has the Greek orientation, and the grade levels are different. One is K-5 and one is K-9 and growing. So the opportunities are somewhat limited, but Odyssey had its 10th anniversary celebration, and it was a Greek Olympics heritage type day. They invited the academia kids over to participate and get involved with that. On the other hand, when academia had its Hispanic heritage celebration, they invited the kids from Odyssey to come over. So they're meshing in that respect. They both schools use the soccer field that separates the two buildings that they use. They use that for recess. There's a playground that Odyssey has built that the academia kids use. The cafeteria is on Odyssey's property, and they cook all the food for the lunches for academia, and they bring that over for the academia kids to eat in their own building. So there are a lot of things like that are going on. They're talking possibly next year about figuring out if there's a way of merging their bus routes so that rather than two sets of buses traversing different areas of Newcastle County, one bus could come and take the kids for both academia and Odyssey and bring them to and from school.
I imagine that would be where maybe future collaboration, if they were looking to do more or bigger things, would lie, would be more in those kind of logistics and infrastructure, maybe not so much in the academic realm itself.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, this is the same sort of thing that you see occasionally with Delaware's traditional public school districts, where they're doing things like ordering supplies together as, you know, as a way of saving costs.
With no new charters on the horizon, but interest in them still relatively high, I imagine both schools are pretty optimistic about their future and their ability now to maybe grow at this site.
Well, I think, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, Nick Manolakos, who is the head of school at Odyssey, points out when we're talking that charter schools seem to have a perception to be safer than some traditional public schools. Many of them have a reputation for higher academic achievement, for possibly being a better environment for learning. And he adds, you know, certainly in his case and academia's case, there is a growing public fascination with this idea of acquisition of a second language. So you take all of that together, and you can see why the operators of charter schools, at least the ones that are experiencing some success already, and you can see why they are hopeful for the future, that they would expect to, you know, maintain their enrollments and even continue to grow.
And your story does hint at the possibility of another charter coming in at this Bartley Mill Plaza location. What, if anything, do we know about that at this point?
Well, we don't know anything specific. What we do know is that behind the building that academia is in is an identically sized building that is connected to academia by a second story pedestrian overpass. The academia people say that they're thinking about in the early stages of perhaps adding a middle school program, which would take them from rather being K-5 to be K-8. And if that's the case, they would talk to Odyssey about leasing this adjoining building and putting their middle school there. On the other hand, Nick Manolakos at Odyssey says, I've had some calls from other charter schools that might also be interested in that space. So it's not necessarily a sure thing that academia would get it. And as you know, the charter landscape is continually evolving. There is this interest in dual language programming. The state is doing immersion programming now, not only in Spanish but also in Chinese. It's not out of the realm of probability that another organization might come in and say, hey, we'd like to start a dual language charter in yet another language, and it would be kind of nice to be out where these two are. And, you know, Mark Phelps, who's the headmaster at Academia, has pretty much said the same thing, that, you know, if we could have a third charter school on this site that is dedicated toward teaching yet another language, it would be a great testimonial to multiculturalism, multilingualism, and send a strong message to the community that this is what people in Delaware really care about. So, we really don't know. Everything is pretty speculative, but the seeds are for something along those lines have at least been planted.
Thanks again to contributor Larry Nagengast for his time this week, and a reminder that his piece on Odyssey and Academia, Antonia Alonso, is available online right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, arts groups locally are worried that the Trump administration may cut funding for the National Endowment for the Arts. We'll discuss what they say it could mean here in the first state next. Stay with us. You are listening to Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The Trump administration threatens to shake up funding in Washington, D.C., and the arts may not be spared a spot on that chopping block. The Hill newspaper has reported the White House is considering defunding the National Endowment for the Arts. In our latest arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart talked with Delaware Arts Alliance Executive Director Guillermina Gonzalez about what that could mean for arts here in the first state.
Recently, a few major publications have reported the Trump administration is considering eliminating the National Endowment for the Arts. Mm-hmm. And what would happen to the arts in Delaware if, say, that happened?
Well, let's be clear in where we are in terms of the elimination of the National Endowment for the Arts. It's too early in the game to consider that like something is going to happen for sure. There's a lot of, it's too early in the game. So there are a few steps that are going to happen prior to that. The new administration is expected to have a budget proposal by the end of February. But then the continuing resolution happens until April 28th. So there's a lot that needs to happen. In other words, what he proposes or his administration proposes needs to go to the legislative branch, and then things might happen then. In between, there's the National Arts Advocacy Day happening, as you know, on March 20 and 21st. Where Americans for the Arts and all the allies, including Delaware Arts Alliance, convene in Washington, D.C. to make the case for the arts very clear. The Delaware Division of the Arts received funding from two different sources. One is the General Assembly that, rounding numbers, provides 80% of the money that goes to the Delaware Division of the Arts, a close ally of the Delaware Arts Alliance, part of the Department of State, so they cannot advocate for themselves, but that's the reason for the AA to exist, to help unify the sector from that perspective. So that the General Assembly provides 80%, and then 20% comes from federal resources, equaling the National Endowment for the Arts. So the potential impact specifically for Delaware might affect that 20%. So it's important to be mindful about this and begin galvanizing the troops and informing people where we are. We might need to have advocacy activities, importantly, to prevent this from happening. But again, at this point, it's too early in the game. It's important to keep that in mind because some people might be alarming about this. This is just news. that were leaked to The Hill, a newspaper in the Washington, D.C. area, about staffers commenting about the possibility of doing that. It was picked up also by an article editorial page in the Wall Street Journal. Again, it's an editorial page. It's the opinion of somebody. And I believe that also the New York Times. Again, so those are comments. Nothing has happened yet and might not happen, but it could well happen. So there's impact for Delaware, as I said, in the 20% that goes to the Delaware Division of the Arts that forms the state arts budget.
So it is something that was leaked from staffers. It's not something that the president has gone out and said.
Nothing.
And there's nothing concrete to, well, basically they're just rumors as of now.
In essence, yes. But it's important to keep an eye on these kind of things. But it might signal something happening or considering or taking into consideration for the new administration. Now, again, it's too early in the game, but let's keep an eye on that and monitoring the situation.
So let's say the administration goes to the extreme and they decide to try and eliminate the National Endowment for the Arts, and it goes through the legislative branch and it is effectively eliminated. What would that look like for the state of Delaware?
Well, as I said, the direct impact is the stopping of the 20% of the money that comes to the Delaware Division of the Arts, which is important because, as you know, it's money that that many organizations depend on, grantees that receive money directly from the Delaware Division of the Arts, but also art institutions that depend on the money that is provided by the Delaware Division of the Arts. So this is not to be taken lightly if that happens, because there are many organizations that could be affected. In fact, just to give you an idea of the many things that happen throughout or by virtue of the money given by the National Endowment for the Arts. It goes together with the 80% of the General Assembly. But those funds, among other things, for instance, help Reading arts activities for preschoolers, arts therapy for adults, after-school arts programs, community development programs, arts education programs. So it's a variety of activities that might be negatively impacted if things happen. So it's not to be taken lightly.
And has the DAA and the DDOA, the Delaware Division of the Arts, and other arts stakeholders within the state, have they gotten together to discuss what might happen, what they would do in case of the extreme option?
Right. We began having conversations. As you know, Delaware is very fortunate to have Delaware Division of the Arts that relates very nicely and solidly with arts advocacy, like in this case, the Delaware Arts Alliance. So we began having discussions. Nothing has been defined yet, because again, it's too early in the game. It's important to always have Plan B. So we began having discussions, but nothing has been materialized yet. We might have a plan if things happen. There are options that we can consider, but we'll share that at a more pertinent time. Right now, we don't have anything concrete to share at this time.
President Donald Trump is not the only new administration.
Right.
We also have Governor John Carney, who was just elected, and it has been said that he's going to carry the mantle of his predecessor. He's going to carry the mantle of Jack Markell and be a fighter for the arts. Mm-hmm. You were a member of his transition team.
Yes.
And what does Governor Carney think? What does this administration think of the arts, and how are they going to propel the arts in the future?
Well, I cannot speak for his administration. What I can say is that the arts were considered in a more pragmatic way. He certainly is an arts believer, and just to make a point about that, probably you were there, his inaugural activities included two arts events, one in Sussex County, to be specific, at Clear Space, and the other one here in Wilmington. With that, it signals the importance of the arts in this administration. Now, his approach to the arts, at least what was discussed, again, I cannot speak for his administration, is more of tools of retention and recruitment. in the sense that the arts can provide, and we know it does, quality of life, not only for Delawareans, but for those individuals that consider Delaware a point of destination. So it was more related in terms of economic development and how the arts can play a pivotal role in attracting individuals that are considering Delaware, again, as a point of destination, but also providing reasons for people living in Delaware to keep living in Delaware, simply because this is a place that offers that quality of life.
The DAA touts the arts as an economic driver in the state. Right. It's a top 10 employer, right?
Correct. Correct. I'm glad that you did your homework, because indeed it's, yes, it's provides close to 4,000 full-time jobs. It's an industry the size of $142 million. And as you know, it provides almost $10 million back to the state's economy. And if you consider the money that is given to the Delaware Division of the Arts, making the story short, it's a 2.5 return on investment, which is a terrific return on investment considering challenging economic times. So this is not to be taken lightly. The arts in Delaware mean business and can help a lot in providing reasons for people to see that there's quality of life.
So as we sit now, there's a little bit of smoke, there's no fire, but the Delaware Division of the Arts and the Delaware Arts Alliance and the state are forming a plan B, or are starting to keep an ear to the ground.
To be exact, we are monitoring the situation, not only internally, but also at the federal level. As you know, the Delaware Arts Alliance works very closely with Americans for the Arts that represent the interest of many states. At the very minimum, the State Arts Action Network represents more than 45 different art alliances across the nation. So we have the knowledge of Americans for the Arts. They live in Washington. They know exactly what's happening at any given time. So we've been in constant contact to keep monitoring the situation. And by the same token, we keep close contact with the Delaware Division of the Arts and arts advocates across the state. So if we need to pivot at any given time, we're going to do that, and we can do that immediately. The good news is that we keep each other posted on moves, and if we need to implement Plan B or C, that is going to happen very fast.
Thanks to our Mark Earhart and Guillermina Gonzalez of the Delaware Arts Alliance for their time this week. Next on The Green, we often cover issues surrounding the state's poultry industry, but we rarely talk about the daily work of chicken farmers. So science reporter Kay Pike has decided to offer a snapshot of that, and we'll bring it to you after a look at your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Poultry is big business in Delaware, and issues surrounding it, ranging from the building of new mega chicken houses to the environmental impact of the industry, are stories we often delve into. But in the process of that reporting, we don't often paint a picture of what the day-to-day life of a local poultry farmer is like. So this week, as she works on a related story, Delaware Public Media science reporter Katie Pikus takes us inside a local organic chicken house to get a better feel for its operations.
Georgie Cartanza is a Dover area chicken grower.
Typically, you know, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I come out here, I make sure everybody has food and water, I check the air quality.
The birds are delivered to Cartanza's farm the day they hatch. She raises 148,000 organic chickens at a time, split between four houses.
In organic, we actually dump the chickens ourselves. So they come in on a pallet. There's like 13,000 chickens in 1,300 crates. There's 100 birds in a little box, basically.
When I visited her farm recently, the chicks were just over 3 weeks old. During those first 3 weeks, Cartanza says the first 2 weeks are critical.
These are my babies, the first 2 weeks. You establish a lot of things right there in the health of the bird, those first 2 weeks.
From here on out, the majority of her job is making sure the chicks are comfortable and healthy. It's one of the biggest challenges of poultry growing, but she makes sure the chicks are in good shape by assessing the conditions of her houses daily.
We're getting rid of any birds that may not be developing right. We may euthanize them. We're checking the drinker height. We're looking at the feeder height. We're looking at, you know, is there any light bulbs that are not working? You know, are the birds sufficiently warm?
Cartanza also checks to see if the birds need oregano or vitamins. If the birds' droppings are loose, she'll run a little bit of vinegar through a drinking system to help the birds digest their food better. And along with a helper, she checks for dead birds and removes them from the house. Over the next few weeks, she watches the chicks develop and expand throughout a chicken house the size of 2 football fields. When they're first brought in, they only take up about 40% of the house, but week by week, they grow into it.
And they'll grow out in this area until they're 7 weeks old.
And once they're 7 weeks old, they start the next leg of their journey.
All these windows will be closed up, they'll be covered up, so it's dark in the house. That helps keep the birds really calm. There's a crew of people called Live Haul that come in with a forklift and cages, and they catch the birds and transport them to the processing plant, and they're processed.
Cartanza says 20 years ago, the poultry growing industry seemed more driven by cost. But the modern consumer has become more conscious about what they eat. As a result, the industry has changed.
You know, we get a lot of outside auditing now to make sure that, are you following your animal welfare practices? Are you doing the things you say you're doing? All those things occur to make sure we are doing what we're supposed to be doing.
Dan Shortridge, the former communications manager with Delaware's Department of Agriculture, says the chicken growing industry has a stake in Delaware thanks to family farmers. Last year, Delaware's 670 family farms produced over 240 million brother chickens, bringing in $2.7 billion. More than 4,000 people are employed in the industry.
Our family farmers are absolutely key to this industry. They're the central point for these thousands of jobs. Without them, we would lose a significant part of our economy. And that's part of why we're so determined to protect our industry, both economically and from diseases.
That includes diseases like the avian influenza. Delaware has not seen a major case of the fatal flu since 2004, but farmers throughout the state and the Chesapeake region are still taking measures to protect their farms. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie. And we'll hear again from Katie in the coming weeks about research being done to help track avian flu and make sure local farmers are ready to deal with it should it surface in the region. And The Green continues in a moment with another piece from our Generation Voice project at Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, looking at the school-to-prison pipeline. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, Governor John Carney announced he'll initiate an independent review of the immediate and underlying causes of last week's hostage incident at Vaughn Correctional Center that left a correctional officer, Lieutenant Stephen Floyd, dead. It came the same day the Delaware Coalition of Prison Reform and Justice called for an independent federal investigation into the state's correctional system in the wake of that incident. The coalition pointed to a number of issues it sees contributing to creating the poor conditions that led to last week's standoff with prisoners. Among them, the inadequate education of children from impoverished backgrounds, and unequal punishments for black and white students in some schools. The latter creates what's been called the school-to-prison pipeline, and it's an issue that recently caught the attention of a student in our Generation Voice project at Mount Pleasant High School's radio station WMPH. And we thought it might be interesting to hear what that student, sophomore Amaya Williams, learned when she took a closer look at the issue from the student's perspective.
The phrase school-to-prison pipeline is used to explain a growing phenomenon in schools across America. Studies have shown that the more times a student faces in-school and out-of-school suspensions, the more likely they are to drop out of school, become incarcerated, and get involved in violent crime, hence the name school-to-prison pipeline. Students of color who get in trouble during school for something as minor as being late for or unprepared to class or violating dress code rules are much more likely to be suspended than their white peers. In 2013, close to 14,000 out-of-school suspensions were given to students in Delaware schools, and while black students made up only 32% of the student body that year, they accounted for 67% of these suspensions. My name is Amaya Williams, and I'm a student at Mount Pleasant High School. As a student of color myself, I wanted to talk to some of my peers and some experts to figure out why this is happening and what's being done to address it. The school-to-prison pipeline has affected some of my classmates at Mount who've had unfortunate encounters with school authority. I spoke to one of my classmates, David, a sophomore at Mount Pleasant, about his experiences with school discipline. He shared with me what administration told him on his first day at Mount Pleasant.
When I first came to Mount, they reminded me that, like, you know, we're in high school now, so, and according to my previous record, if I get into another fight, I'm either going to go to juvie or jail.
In elementary school, David got into a fight with another student who happened to be white. The other student started the fight, but David was the one who was suspended.
I had to spend like 2 days at home while he was coming to school.
David missed out on valuable school time and had trouble catching up.
I think it damaged my reputation because, like, a lot of teachers tell me I'm a smart kid, and because I got suspended a lot in elementary school, I had to redo like a lot of classes. I never got held back, but I was always like behind in my work, so I think it kind of made me rush instead of like actually learning the material.
While David has been out of danger since then, other students haven't been so lucky. One former Delaware student is facing a lifetime jail sentence. He first got in trouble for carving his name in the back of a school bus seat.
It started when he was in the fifth grade. It was what they, you know, termed a dangerous weapon. He was expelled and, you know, his life just kind of careened out of control after that.
That's Shannon Griffin, a community organizer with Delaware's ACLU chapter. Griffin is currently working with the mother of that student. A root cause of this problem is what's known as the zero tolerance policy, during which a student is severely penalized for juvenile disciplinary problems. Griffin says the zero tolerance policy isn't new.
Shooting in Columbine really kind of was the impetus for a lot of schools going to zero tolerance. And I think it's a huge negative impact. I mean, when we talk about, you know, the idea of students being involved in a criminal justice system, more often than not, they're first introduced to the system, not in their neighborhoods, regardless of how rough they may be perceived, it's in school.
This policy has been in play for about 15 years.
The zero tolerance policy has created a breeding ground for children to ultimately end up in the prison system.
That's former Wilmington City Councilwoman Sherry Dorsey Walker. She and Griffin agree that policy often translates to a school-wide mentality. Griffin says schools have a tendency to influence negative behavior instead of enforcing the positive.
You know, what I hear from parents is sometimes they don't even want to answer the phone because they only hear from the schools when it's a problem.
Griffin said the mother of the student mentioned earlier, who was in possession of the carving knife, pleaded for school officials to provide help for her son.
His mother, who I know really well, you know, was crying out for help. She's saying, listen, he needs some more resources. He needs some more services.
She added there is a serious problem with the lack of early interventions in schools. Many students only qualify to receive mental health counseling after multiple serious offenses. The incident with the carving knife also wasn't considered a serious offense.
You know, they're like, well, you know, what he did wasn't bad enough to kick in additional services that could possibly benefit it.
However, Dorsey Walker says there was no one method for discipline. Each child is different and requires a unique approach. David agreed with both Griffin and Walker that alternate methods would do the least amount of harm to a student. David shared an alternate form of discipline that his school put in place for students like him.
Due to my attitude, I was enrolled in a special group that would leave the class every once in a while, a few times a week. Basically, attitude adjustment.
Dorsey Walker added many school administrators and state officials don't understand the impact of district-level discipline policies.
You'll never understand the circumstances of some of our children until you've taken the time to just be in their shoes.
Still, David has significantly improved since that fight. He says that by middle school, things started getting slowly better. Although he wasn't perfect, his act started to straighten out. He even began to make peace with his former enemies by the time he reached middle school. Coming to Mount Pleasant High was a real eye-opener for him.
Well, yeah, as soon as I came to Mount, my act was kind of straightened up. I kind of took the high road. Instead of fighting with my fist, I kind of fight with my mouth now, so I'm more of a smart aleck, have a higher vocabulary, so that's even better.
He went from being a child threatened with being thrown into juvenile hall to a very accomplished student with a reputation for his intelligence and kind, loving nature.
The me right now, I don't like to have enemies or anything. I know a lot of kids right now that I used to fight a lot, and we're like the best of friends. I got one kid who I used to fight a lot. We're partners in cooking class, and it's just like the new David is more peaceful than the other David.
Shannon Griffin said it best.
First of all, you have to see each other as human beings. I mean, I really think it's just that basic.
For Generation Voice, this is Maya.
Our thanks to Mount Pleasant High School sophomore Maya Williams for this piece, and thanks to our Generation Voice youth media producer Megan Pauling for guiding its production. And The Green wraps up next with Enlighten Me and the story of a 52-year-old college student who went from being homeless to studying at Penn. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Pern. We wrap up this week's show with an upbeat story from contributor Eileen Dalabrida. Her latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org, chronicles the story of Vernell Brown, a 52-year-old student at the University of Pennsylvania. You heard me right, a 52-year-old student. Eileen tells us it's Brown's second shot at an Ivy League education after drugs and alcohol derailed his first over 30 years ago. It's an uplifting story about second chances and the power of perseverance and support. And Eileen Dalabrida joins us now for this week's Enlighten Me to tell us more about it. Thanks for joining us, Eileen.
Happy to be here, Tom.
Well, let's start off with how did you first learn about Vernell Brown and his story?
I first met Vernell a couple of years ago through the Ministry of Caring,
and in Wilmington. And he had just begun classes at Dell Tech. And I thought that, wow, this is highly unusual for a guy who lives in a homeless shelter to be going to college. And he invited me to be his Facebook friend. And I said, I'd love to be Facebook friends with you. And he has been in my thoughts and my prayers ever since.
Your story details how, as a child, he seemed to be on a path towards success. What went wrong, and how did he get to the point where he was homeless and kind of had a chance to go to an Ivy League school when he was younger, essentially disappear?
He was a very he was a sensitive boy. He had an unconventional upbringing. His mother always had heart problems and was gravely ill. He had a brother who had cerebral palsy and was confined to a wheelchair. He was surrounded by illness. And when he was 6 years old, his parents got divorced and his father essentially abandoned the family.
And I guess that started him down a path perhaps that kind of to unravel, you know, what had seemed to be a trajectory that was going in the right direction.
Well, he always loved school and he loved studying, and he got a tremendous break when he got a scholarship to Tatnall in seventh grade. But it wasn't soon after that that he started drinking and doing drugs. He had a lot on his plate. He wanted to be in with the in crowd. And he was going to a school where a lot of the kids were affluent, and he came from more modest needs, and he wanted to fit in with them. And he also was struggling with his sexuality. He came to the awakening that he was gay, and he didn't want to be gay. He felt like there was something wrong with him, and he wanted to hide it. He wanted to numb those feelings, and drugs and alcohol fit the bill.
Was there a point that kind of really was a turning point in the wrong direction for him, where things really kind of broke down and set him on a path that, as you mentioned, you know, wound up with him, you know, being homeless and trying to rebuild his life?
He had a lot of opportunities and he made a lot of mistakes. His scholarship offer was taken away from Brown University. He went to Howard, but he spent his whole time there, doing drugs and hanging out with other kids who are doing drugs. They find one another. It's like radar.
Mm-hmm.
They all get in trouble together. So he came back and he started temping, but he was just not disciplined. He wasn't able to hold a job. He started stealing, shoplifting, and forging checks, and he wound up in prison.
And so he tried to keep going, went to Howard, flunked out of Howard, and he said kind of wound up on this kind of path to jail. What happened after he wound up in prison once he got out, and how did he start to kind of rebuild his life?
Well, prison was actually a pretty positive experience for him because he was able to take some college classes. And academics and learning has always been something that he gravitates towards and that he loves. So when he got out of prison, he started to do a little bit better. The jobs lasted a little bit longer. He wasn't getting in trouble as much, but he just couldn't stay away from crack cocaine and beer. So he wound up losing his last job, and he didn't have a place to go. He was homeless. And he asked his mom, who loved him unconditionally and supported him through all his problems, if he could move in with her. And she said, "Son, I love you, but no." And that was it. That for him was the bottom, that he didn't want to live that kind of life any longer. He wanted to have a home, and he wound up at the Ministry of Caring, where they essentially compelled him to go to meetings of a 12-step program. And if you want a roof over your head, you have to stay clean and sober. And he was completely humbled, and he said, okay. And then he started going to school, this time with a renewed appreciation, renewed enthusiasm, a great deal of vigor, and wound up getting a 4.0 at Dell Tech.
And then how did he wind up getting an opportunity to go to Penn from there?
Penn has a program for non-traditional students, and he was invited to apply. So he applied, and 2 weeks later, he got his letter that said, you're in. And he was just, you know, elated, walking on air. And this was his second chance at the Ivy Leagues, and this time he was ready for it.
Now, your piece says he's on pace to graduate in May 2018. What does he see himself doing once he gets his degree?
Well, he's very passionate about public health, having grown up surrounded by illness. And he is also very interested in policy, in informing policy that can help people to lead healthier, more productive lives. He is, in many ways, even though he's 52 years old, he's very much a student. He lives in the dorm. He eats in the cafeteria with the other students. He has a part-time job in the cafeteria. And he's studying hard. So far, he's only gotten one B in sociology. Other than that, he's been all straight A's. And he gets a lot of support, from the 12-step community, from his extended family. His mother was one of 16 children, so he has a lot of very loving aunts and uncles and cousins. And he has a great church family at Bethel AME, and his faith has really helped him a lot, too.
And real quick, what is he studying at Penn?
He is studying public health.
Okay. What do you think people can take away from Brown's story? I mean, and what did you take away from it as you kind of, you know, told this story for us?
It's that the human spirit can't be crushed. I mean, while there's breath, there's hope. I think that there are a lot of reasons for people to give up on Vernell and for Vernell to give up on himself, but that never happened, and he turned it around.
Eileen Dalabrida, we thank you so much for enlightening us this week with Vernell Brown's story and joining us here on The Green.
Thanks, Tom.
And a reminder that Eileen's piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. It is definitely worth your time. And that's it for this week's edition of The Green. These stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributors Eileen Dalabrida and Larry Nagengast. Mount Pleasant High School sophomore Amaya Williams, part of our Generation Voice project in the Brandywine School District. Delaware Public Media's Mark Earhart and Katie Pikus, as well as our president and station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.